Just King Things Bound to Sound.
Oh, shit. Hold on. I forgot for the atmosphere, the important atmosphere here.
Mercedes dog. Wow.
Because when I think of detectives investigating murders in Ohio, this is what I think of.
There was a car.
There was a Mercedes.
A guy hit him with a car.
Oh, God.
You know what I think of?
Uh-huh.
I think about the song Here Comes Your Man.
Yeah. I think about a turtle. I think about a tortoise.
Okay. I got to ask you a question. Where'd that come from? Miss Mercedes, okay, sorry, real quick. Miss Mercedes, television program. They made a TV show out of Mr. Mercedes that, where did it initially premiere?
It aired on the Audience Network.
Yeah, the Audience. I've never heard of the Audience Network.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
It was an American pay cable or pay television channel that was owned by AT&T from 2005 to it featured a mix of original and acquired series, specials, and feature films. The network operated as a commercial-free service and broadcast its programming without editing for content. It was originally exclusive to DirecTV, though it was also added to AT&T UVerse after the
25th. Yeah, AT&T UVerse, my right. favorite platform.
Right. Mm-hmm. It was also made available on later AT&T streaming efforts, such as AT&T TV and AT&T Watch TV, a lower-cost option available to AT&T mobility customers.
Oh, my God. So you got, like, watching on a cell phone?
The channel closed on May 22nd, 2020.
It's interesting. Okay, so it had several partnerships with NBC as well. They broadcast Friday Night Lights on there. They acquired Passions.
Yeah. Huh.
That's an interesting thing to learn about. They had a lot of, like, juice on this network for being a thing that I've never heard of.
Yeah.
They had a lot of reruns, like General Hospital Night Shift.
Uh-huh.
Ran on there.
They had the syndication rights to Oz and Deadwood.
And The Wire.
Huh.
Weird. It's just like, you know, it's what back in the day, you remember, you know, many times on the show, we've talked about, especially you, Michael, like watching like Sunday afternoon syndicated television.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like a big thing in your life. And what that turned into in the 2000s was like this.
You know, a weird, which is like, channel.
You could catch four episodes of Deadwood on a DirecTV only channel owned by AT&T. Weird.
Hmm.
But they got a lot of juice because they also acquired Wonderland, the Peter Berg TV show.
Huh.
Apparently controversial. Don't know anything about this. They did that. And then they also did this Mr. Mercedes show. This Mr. Mercedes show is star-studded, number one,
mm-hmm.
and produced by one of the, like, TV royalty.
Yeah. Yeah.
David E. Kelly did this.
Most famous for, like, the 90s and early 2000s legal drama, comedy drama, actually, because that's the thing, is he did legal dramas, but they were also always a little bit funny. He did Ally McBeal, for instance. He also did a cult classic horror comedy film, Lake Placid.
Mm-hmm.
So
he can do it all.
Yeah.
David E. Kelly. And Mystery Alaska.
Oh, he did that too? Huh.
Yes, he wrote looks like produced it. But yeah, Mystery Alaska, if people aren't familiar with that, it's kind of like what if the Mighty Ducks was like a ragtag team of people in Alaska doing that?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like a Hoosiers for Alaska.
Yeah, for a slightly hipper, younger people than us, I guess. He also developed Big Little Lies for television.
He did it all for Big Little Lies too.
Huh?
created it, wrote it. Yeah, he did a lot of like just big stuff that matters. And like other things that are like big critical hits that you might not be familiar with. So Goliath, I don't know if you watched that, but that was the Billy Bob Thornton like legal drama that that kind of launched, not launched, but was a significant early hit for Amazon Prime.
Oh, okay. I'd never heard of that, video I think. Thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I watched a couple seasons of that. It was fine. And so, yeah, this is like a big deal. But yeah, doing the double of Boston Public and Boston Legal is like legitimately impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And The Practice and Ally McDeal and Doogie Howser, MD. Mm-hmm. He created Doogie Howser.
Oh, he created Doogie Howser? I thought he was just involved.
No, he and Stephen Bochco.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Damn. Okay.
Previous Hollywood royalty, Stephen Bochco, the guy who created Hill Street Blues. Can you imagine being like, listen, I'm going to create perhaps the most iconic cop show of the last 50 years. And I want to get a TV show in there about a little teen doctor. Well, now you're Stephen Bochco.
Little teen doctor and his computer.
That's right. Do all that stuff. So, yeah, so this is like a real, and I got to tell you, out of all the like modern adaptations we've watched of Stephen King stuff, this is the best one by a huge margin.
I think so. Yeah.
I don't even know if I like it. But I think it's the best one.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's a very smart adaptation. It's fun. It knows where to kind of like fill things out and which characters are interesting to spend a little extra bit of time with. It knows how to shuffle things around to make this into a 3-season TV series that maybe has some more gas in the tank than a straight adaptation of the book would have done. And it has that tortoise.
Yeah. Let me do a little Google here. Why? Or actually a little DuckDuckGo.
Yeah.
Why did they give Bill Hodges a tortoise?
I think it's because Stephen King had a pet tortoise.
Is that true?
I believe so. There's been, we've talked about this, maybe not on the show, and I know it's definitely come up in the Discord, is that there's one review from maybe the late 90s or the early 2000s that makes a passing mention to a tortoise walking through his yard while the interviewer is at his house.
That's right.
So
we have talked about this,
right? I kind of suspect that like David E. Kelly had a meeting with Stephen King and the tortoise was there and he was like, well, damn, that's going in the show.
Disturbing to me to think of Steve with a big turtle like that, or a big tortoise.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why.
Yeah.
It's disturbing to me, but it is somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. For the person who has maybe only listened to the mainline episode and has not watched this show, Bill Hodges has a pet tortoise that lives in his yard and he goes out and he throws lettuce at it.
Yep. That's it.
That's it. It's like and a character note. Like,
Okay. So let's talk about the cast real quick.
Okay.
All right. So if you listen to the mainline episode, the plot is nearly identical. There's some weaving going on here, but in terms of like the whole big picture sketch of the season, it's a straightforward adaptation that, as you said, Michael, there's some useful pieces moving around in order to make sure you can like keep the show going,
mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to do more than one season. Big people behind the scenes, like we just talked about, David E. Kelly, probably the other one. We mentioned this on the mainline episode, but they've got Dennis Lehane,
mm-hmm.
who is a crime writer, like a pretty popular crime writer. Very mm-hmm. not a pretty, he's a very popular crime writer. working on the like teleplay part of it,
mm-hmm.
or like he's actually not writing the teleplays. He has come in to do some big picture producing and consulting on the show,
mm-hmm.
and then some of the teleplays are written by him. Some of them are just straight up written by David E. Kelly.
Yep. And Dennis Lehane, for people who that's maybe sounds familiar, but you can't place him to anything, probably most well known for Mystic River or the Martin Scorsese film Shutter Island. And then notably, I was thinking about this because I started watching this show not too long after we watched It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Murder. Mm-hmm. For Shell by Genre. If you're not a Shell by Genre listener, in between units, we typically watch a Hallmark movie. In the last unit, we actually did a Lifetime movie. And one of the things that came out of that is that it was directed by Dennis Lehane's wife. So it occurred to me.
It Dennis Lehane's wife? I thought that was directed by the guy who wrote Mother of the Brooklyn.
What?
Yeah, pretty sure. I hope that it was. Who's the guy who wrote?
Yeah, it was directed by Amy Barrett. Oh, no, sorry. I got it. She's married to Jonathan Lethem. Okay.
Yeah,
I was
Jonathan
too excited.
Lethem. That's what
that
I thought. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know why Motherless Brooklyn was my pull. Yes. Jonathan Lethem, but that was the pull.
Okay, that works out. For a minute, I was thinking the connection that I thought that I had made would be like, oh, okay, if Dennis Lehane is married to her, then obviously then there's like some like production stuff. Like what I was going to say is, this is a show that has some money behind it, I think particularly in the people, but otherwise looks like it could have been pretty cheap to produce because it is a bunch of people sitting around in houses talking to each other.
Yeah, they don't look like they have a lot of money to like find locations or build sets or anything like that. And it was shot in South Carolina somewhere. I looked this up last night and now I've forgotten. Not Spartanburg, but let me look here. Where was it filmed? Charleston. Charleston, South Carolina. That's where they did it. Because a lot of the like strip mall kind of stuff looked like stuff around here. And I was like, was this a Georgia? But no, it's a South Carolina. So similar style, you know, for that kind of thing. And but it's what's really interesting to me about like behind the scenes, right? So bringing in Lehane, bringing in David, or, you know, David E. Kelley doing the thing, but also A.M. Holmes. Do you know who this is?
No.
Amy Holmes wrote The End of Alice, if you remember that book.
Okay.
Big, like, true crimey, like, it's not actually true crime, but like crime novel, I guess, in the thing. And has just been involved in like a bunch of different stuff. She did. It looks like she wrote for The L Word and stuff like that. It's just like a person in the world who I was, you know, familiar with. But when looking at who was writing the episodes, I was like, oh, they're bringing in not just TV people. You know, they're bringing in to work on the show folks who are better known for writing lengthy fiction. So I thought it was pretty interesting that the writer's room is a team of novelists, crime writers, things like that, not just people who write sitcoms or whatever. So that's pretty neat. And I think probably has something to do with why I feel like this is a really solid show. Because as you just said, part of the production here is like, you just get this good cast in a room and you get them talking to each other and you have them deliver complicated lines and words. That's it. That's the show. And like, not every Stephen King adaptation gets to do that.
It's a very solid, I would say, it is probably the thing that we've watched for these bonus episodes that my wife has enjoyed the most. She was like, I don't think this is like great TV, but it's the type of TV that I can just sit and watch for a while. So, we moved through this at a pretty good clip. Can we talk about, how do we want to handle this? Cause like,
well, let's talk about the cast.
Yes. Okay.
Let's Who's start doing there. What? And then we'll talk about the differences. And we'll just talk about what we enjoyed the most.
Yeah. Okay.
Seems easy.
The big one, main character as Bill Hodges. This is actually a pretty good choice. I mean, not pretty good. I think it's an excellent choice. It's Brendan Gleeson.
He's so damn good.
Yeah. He brings so much character to this role. I'm not saying that like, in the book, Bill Hodges needed to be Irish, but damn, it helps.
They fixed it,
right?
Like all the weird things is what we were talking about, the Kermit thing.
Yes.
His first name being Kermit is really odd. And then he was like, I'm from Ireland. I was like, his name is Kermit.
Yeah.
That's fine. His name is Kermit. That checks out to me. It makes a lot of sense. I'm okay with it. Now, do I know if that's an Irish name? No, I don't know anything about the name Kermit. But it could be.
Yes. Right. It just feels like, yeah, I guess at some point a child could have been born in Ireland in the late 50s who got named Kermit.
Yeah. He's got great hair. He's got a great beard. And you can just say the damn words. You can also frown. This is a TV show. And look, in an era of TV that's just not like this anymore, where there's just a scene where someone says a word and they look at someone else and we cut to that person and they frown and we cut back to the original person and they frown and two people frown at one another for like 40 seconds. And weirdly enough, and that's good. That's acting. Like, acting gets to happen, right? Mm-hmm. I think it all has to do with the fact that this has commercial breaks in it.
Yeah.
Like, they're writing for the commercial break. Like, you get to have two big scenes.
Yes.
There's a commercial, and then there's two big scenes, and they can take as long as you want them to, and then we cut to commercial, and we go back. There's none of this, like, infinite nightmare time of the streaming television program. Mm-hmm. Like, well, I guess this episode's going to be 58 minutes, so why not? I guess this episode's going to be 41 minutes, sure.
Oh, my God.
Ooh, you know, like, there's an efficiency of the TV writing, right, that actually is good.
Right. Characters need to know what they're doing and when they're doing it, and it helps if they say this stuff out loud so a viewer can follow along sometimes.
Yeah, it is becoming very difficult for me, no matter how acclaimed or cool or whatever, it's becoming very difficult for me to sign on to watch a television show in the streaming era, just period. Because they're ropey, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
I'm not a Game of Thrones. You know, that's just not a thing I care much about one way or the other. And there's the new Game of Thrones. Like, and apparently the only thing positive anyone can find to say about it is it's funny.
Yeah, it's the funny.
So that
Game
seems
of Thrones.
Interesting to me. Like, yeah. Off the bat, okay. You tell me it's not like Game of Thrones? That's what they're implying, right? It's not like this thing that most people liked. Well, okay, cool. I don't really care about that one way or the other, so maybe I'll enjoy it. And then I just think, how many scenes of nothing occurring will be there where no one's acting and we're just hearing people talk? Got to be a lot. It seems impossible. So. You know, I think I'm going through it with TV right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like there was the breath of fresh air. I really enjoyed it because there are people acting and speaking to one another, and the plot keeps moving, as you just said.
Yeah.
So we got Brendan Gleeson. He's knocking out of the park. What do you think about him as Bill Hodges? Is he your iconic Bill Hodges?
I think he's a great Bill Hodges. I think because the presence of Gleeson as like a physical actor, pulls in a lot of stuff that you kind of have to use your imagination for in the book, in terms of, like, it's not like Bill Hodges in the book is like a bad guy or anything, but you meet him and he's just like a miserable son of a bitch. Like, he's just in a horrible place and he feels terrible about himself. And when you are living in his head, like, that's your introduction to the character. Whereas here it's like, oh, when I'm looking at him, when he's Brendan Gleeson, I can see he's a grouchy old man who is occasionally warm and helpful and whatever. Right. So I think, mm-hmm. I think Brendan Gleeson is great here. I think he is great for that role. And yeah, him being Irish just makes the character feel I think it does what the Kermit thing is trying to do, which is make him feel a little distinctive, right? It's like trying to give you a hook or something for him. And it's like, yeah, okay, he's like Irish and his name is Kermit and he's got a tortoise and he's got a new character, a lady neighbor who is desperate to get it on with him.
Yeah, it's great, actually.
I love it. She's so fun. And this is where you can feel like the David E. Kelly, like, mixing drama with the comedy and like the sort of like character interaction, because just the back and forth between the two of them is wonderful. Her name is Ida, and is she an antiques dealer or something? She's got like a job that is.
I have no idea. You know. She's at home watering her plants all the time.
Yeah. But she's fun because she's like, she's sassy and she knows that Bill Hodges is depressed since his retirement. And she's like, you need to learn to live a little. And what I recommend for this is you having sex with me because I think you're hot. Like, let's do this. She's like very frank and straightforward. And he is at all turns, like, not at all sure what to do with her.
Yeah, not at all. So she's played by Holland Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
who I recognize but couldn't place in like an iconic role. So I'm trying to figure that out right now. Yeah. Of course, she was in Debs.
Mm-hmm. She was in The Practice. She was one of the judges.
She is one of the judges in The Practice. She's in The Truman Show. I think, doesn't she play Truman's mother?
Maybe, yeah.
I think she does.
Oh, and she was in Bill and Ted Face the Music.
Huh. Huh. I was just trying to think of it. She has this very, like, commanding role.
Oh, somewhere. She went to Bennington.
She what?
She went to Bennington.
Dun-dun.
That's why. Like, I just, whenever...
In The Secret History?
Yes, right. Well, it's like, I have been...
A little old for that.
I have been to Bennington and had some interactions with, like, the type of... Not the student, precisely, but, like, the class of person who has a kid who goes to school at Bennington.
Sure.
It's a whole story that's probably not appropriate for this podcast, necessarily. Not that it's an inappropriate story, it's just like a huge digression. But it was one of the weirdest experiences of my life. Like,
why did you go to Bennington for just to check it out?
So here we go. Here we go off in the
end. Don't tell me the whole story. Okay. Just tell me why you went to Bennington.
Oh, we were up there. Like, we wanted to, my wife and I wanted to we had like a long weekend or something. Mm. And occasionally, like, we just go up to New Hampshire and, like, stay in a place for a while. We don't do Vermont that often. And for that reason, we were like, well, we haven't been to Vermont, and we haven't been quite as far north as Bennington. And so we went to Bennington for, like, a long weekend and ended up staying at, like, a bed and breakfast where some Bennington families were coming because it was January and it was just the start of the new semester. And boy, howdy, those were some interesting folks.
Fascinating.
Yep.
Her acting coach was Stella Adler.
Oh, hell. Wow.
Yeah. 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 Notable.
Mm-hmm.
Who else we got here?
I already mentioned Justine Loop or Lupe. I'm sorry, I don't know how to say your last name, as Holly Gibney, who shows up later. We got Jarell Jerome as Jerome Robinson. These are, like, I've seen her in other places. I think I've seen Jarell Jerome in something because I looked him up.
He's in Moonlight. Yeah,
he was in Moonlight. That was it. Apparently, he's the voice of Miles G. Morales in Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, too.
Didn't see that one, yeah. Unfortunately.
Where the hell is... Oh, we missed Brady Hartsfield is Harry Treadaway.
Now, he's a Game of Thrones. Where have I seen this fella before? Isn't he a Game of Thrones?
He looks like a Game of Thrones.
He does. He has a kind of like decayed English look.
He does. Yes.
He definitely is from England. I got here.
I don't think he's a Game of Thrones. I don't think he's a Penny Dreadful. He was Victor Frankenstein in Penny Dreadful.
He's a Penny Dreadful.
Mm-hmm.
Victor Frankenstein, basically a Game of Thrones.
Basically.
You know? You could do that. I also see he's in Control. You ever see Control, that movie?
No.
It's like a biopic about Ian Curtis.
No, I have not seen it.
Anton Corbin film. It has, you know, this is just a historical statement about the world. Ian Curtis, lead singer of Joy Division, kills himself. He hanged himself. And they depict all of that. Not the event happening, but this kind of like thing around it. And I've seen Control a bunch of times. I think it's a good movie. And the depiction of like the hanging scene is one of the most affecting things I've ever seen in a movie. Like, period. And Anton Corbin, you know, is like, that's the deal with all of his work. So, you know, strong recommend for the movie.
Oh, okay.
I'm seeing a poster here that says the coolest British movie of 2007. I don't know if I'd say that, but I think it's a good movie. I think, you know, you might want to check it out.
Okay. Yeah, so I haven't seen him in a whole lot of things. Apparently he was in Picard. I think he does a good job in this role because, you know, they slightly reshape Brady a little bit. A lot of the more extreme stuff from the book, it's like it's all still there, but it gets like toned down or like pressed into slightly different shapes.
Yeah.
So the show makes a bit more of a deal about like Brady as being someone who is not just from the go ontologically evil, that there might in fact have been, even within this story that you're watching, like there is a point at which like it's clearly said, it's like Brady doesn't have to be the thing that he is. Like he could be making different choices and being a different person. And so Treadaway gets to do like that, right? He's a decayed looking like little Gollum-esque Englishman. And so during the parts where Brady has to be just bonkers and a little bit like the he reminded me a lot of the performance that we saw in the Lisi story TV series with the guy who was playing whatever the weird stalker serial killer was in that.
Yeah, who played that? I've got like a real mind gap about who the actor was there.
It was Dane DeHaan. That was it.
That's right. Man, what a little head Dane DeHaan's got. I forgot he was Harry Osborn. Yeah, he's doing a great job, I think. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it. I appreciate what he's doing. He's got a real willing to overact. You know,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Mystery about him. There is something going on with these like contemporary Stephen King or these current like post 2010, let's say, Stephen King adaptations where there's a real like how many times can we present someone as like a disturbed white guy incel?
Uh-huh.
You know?
Uh-huh.
Like how can we rehearse the image of the mass shooter without, you know, saying anything without like, can you do that without having politics? And the answer that TV says is yes.
Uh-huh.
You know, of course you can. We just patiently walk through his life with the world's most infinite amount of empathy, and that will produce an understanding. Finally, we'll understand why white guys do stuff bad. You can perhaps hear my impatience with that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With that storytelling thing. But like, this is just straight up crime novel stuff. It is in fact, you know, you were talking about the mainline episode that there's differences in linearity and lumpiness, you know, with these crime stories. And this, for the most part, the TV show adaptation takes all of the stuff, you know, all the weird in the mix stuff from the book and is like, what is Brady's story? Beats 1 through 7. What is Bill's story? Beats 1 through 7. What is Holly's story, starting with beat 3 through 7?
Mm-hmm.
What is Jerome's story, starting at beat 2, basically, and then through 7? There's a real, like, efficiency of television linearity here that I appreciate.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it feels like it's a very competently done show in that way.
I want to pitch to the part we didn't really talk about, Brady's lesbian friend.
No, because she's not that big in the book.
Yeah, she just kind of comes up. She's someone to ping off of at work, but whatever. But because we got a lot of screen time to fill, right? We got, 450 minutes or so, something like that, of TV to make. We get a lot more of the secondary characters, or the tertiary characters, I guess I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And Brady's whole work thing with his terrible idiot boss, his grind set boss, his Christian grind set boss, I guess, more specifically.
Yeah.
And then she's got a different name here in the TV show.
Yeah,
right?
She's Lou in the TV show. I think she's Fred in the book.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, Lou. Lou Linklater.
Mm-hmm.
Ladder. Whatever. In the thing, played by Breida Wool. And let's say this. I'm going to put this out here. I think if you're a listener and you know Breida Wool, I want Breida Wool on the TV show. Or I want Breida Wool on the podcast.
Oh,
Breida Wool's already on the TV show.
I was going to say, I think she's ahead of us there.
I want her on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Help me out. Because all-timer character.
You know, she does they give this character more to do, and she's great in this role.
I like when there's a person who shows up and she's like, hey, fuck you. You know, that's a good character. And we get this kind of thing because, right, she's a lesbian. She's got, like, tattoos and piercings and all this kind of stuff. And so we get all of these scenes of people coming into this, like, knockoff Best Buy that they work at and just discriminating against her. And her boss is discriminating against her, all this shit, right? Mm-hmm. All this bad stuff happens to her. And she is someone who has a legitimate grievance with the world.
Mm-hmm.
But she's not bombing people at the art opening.
No.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And the book, the show's never saying that loud. It's never been like, look, Brady, you had bad shit happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
But no one goes to work. They go to work all day and they say, you actually could do better than you do. Everyone at work, even his shitty boss, is gassing him up constantly. Brady, if you just made better choices, you would be, you know, top tier. You're a smart guy. You could figure it out, blah, 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 blah. Everyone is shitty to her top to bottom. And she, like, maintains this dignity in the face of that. And not in, like, a misery porn way, but just in a, like, fuck you. Like, why are you treating me this way kind of way?
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, unfortunately, because it's a television show, she has to be harmed
mm-hmm.
at the end. Because it's a television, she's a lesbian on TV, so of course something bad must happen to her.
Right.
We're not going to get out of here without that. But mm-hmm. I really like that. Would love to talk to Brita Wool about the performance.
Mm-hmm. It's very funny on her page on the data slate. If you scroll down, like they have, you know, her headshot or whatever, and you scroll mm-hmm. down and there's a shot of her from like the Mr. Mercedes era. And it's just captioned Mr. Mercedes as if she is Mr. Mercedes.
Brita Wool is Mr. Mercedes.
But yeah, no, she,
I love when there's stuff, you know, on computer 3 from an evil villain that you can look at where you just get to see stuff like Wool favors vegetarian food.
Yes. She favors
put
it.
That in here.
It's not a vegetarian, but she favors it.
It's not a vegetarian, just likes it. Uh-huh. You know,
good stuff.
And then you get some like real fucked up stuff. So it says Wool lives in Los Angeles, California with her boyfriend, Matt Friedman. And you go, okay, who's that? You're like, is that, you know, like another actor I might be familiar with, whatever. Click on a little thing. Yeah, just going to her father's obituary.
Okay.
Which then says who she, you know, is like, that is his daughter. And then also she's, you know, includes her partner in the thing, right? Because uh-huh. that's how obituaries work. Maybe don't do this shit, America, uh-huh. the world. Maybe don't do this.
Not to continue this, but then the next line, Friedman, a music producer and musician, is an outspoken feminist. Another citation. And I just need to figure out what the hell this is, because it's a citation to an article that says Brita Wool's feminist boyfriend, colon, extraordinary man for young age actress soon to be married. What the fuck is this?
So it's just straight up. What? This what? Is just like, this is like ancient slop.
Yeah.
This is slop from 2019. Of like, what do you call it stuff? Like paparazzi slop.
Yes, it is. That is exactly what this is. There's like pictures of him. Oh my God. And it's all based off of like, they've like scraped a picture of him from a social media website where he's wearing the, this is what a feminist looks like t-shirt.
Yeah. We're all the same age. We get it. Looks like he's got a Prince tattoo maybe.
Yeah.
It's just stalking. That's all this is.
That's all this. Okay.
That's all this is. Look, sometimes we talk about all the worst things in society mm-hmm. on this thing. Although, shout him out. So Dr. Richard Patrick Wool, her father, was a PhD in material science.
Oh, that's interesting.
And he taught, it seems like, University of Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
He's a professor of chemical engineering. And they in his after his death, they created the Dr. Richard Wool Award for Women in Green Chemistry.
Oh, that's cool.
That's nice. That's a nice thing to exist.
You know, he probably knew Gene Wolfe.
That's a weird thing to think about.
That is a very weird thing to think about. And like I said, it is a joke. And also, there's a very good chance that it's true.
Yeah, there can't be that many of these guys running around, right? Right.
Well, I mean, Wolfe was there like being an editor on like one of the foremost material science publications for decades.
Yeah, yeah. Green machinery or whatever.
Plant
which
engineering.
Is about plant. Oh, plant machinery. Which is about plants. We all know.
Uh huh.
We all are on the same page about what kind of plant that meant, what that noun refers to.
Yep.
Freeze, so, of course. So yeah, anyway, exactly. Neat stuff. I just think she does a really good job.
Mm-hmm.
And I, every time she was on screen, I was going, yeah. And I really thought she'd like get to beat the shit out of somebody at one point,
mm-hmm.
which kind of happens, I guess. But what else we got?
Let's see.
Any other people sticking out to you here?
Brady. We have Mary Louise Parker as Janie. Who's the woman that Hodges has an affair with, and then she gets exploded. The show is doing an interesting thing with her where I think we're to take her as being a bit more uneven than the Janie in the book is.
Yeah.
Right. So that's interesting. Let's see here. These are people from later seasons. I have no context for any of them.
Oh, I guess the other one to say is Brady's mother.
Yeah, I was trying to find her. Where is she?
I don't know. She's on
she's Kelly
played
Lynch.
By Kelly Lynch. Yeah, she's played by Kelly Lynch, famously from Roadhouse.
Yeah, Deborah Hartsfield.
Yeah. Who, you know, they got, you gotta like, she's also in Drugstore Cowboy, but you gotta... The subtlety, the slow burn of the book of like building up to like what is the nature of their like sexual relationship, whatever, is, you know, hard to know and, you know, hard to understand and hard to kind of figure out. And then you have to like, but in the movie or the TV show, not the movie, in the TV show, you gotta like get that going. So it's literally the first time we see her.
Mm-hmm.
They like nearly have a sexual encounter, or they do have a sexual encounter, it's not nearly.
Yeah.
And so I think some of the slow burnness of the book of introducing the stuff is maybe lost here. But it's devious to cast Kelly Lynch in here, right? Mm-hmm. As like a sex icon from the late 80s, early 90s.
Right. Yeah. And they like, and again, because of the way that this show has different priorities and more space for certain things than the book, Brady's mom is a lot more fleshed out here in the book. I mean, in the book, she exists entirely more or less from Brady's perspective. And so that's like a huge issue because he has all of the, you know, he hates his mother, but also he's deeply compelled by her and attracted to her and all this stuff. And so all of that, all of our interactions with his mom are filtered through kind of his perspective. Whereas in the show, she can exist kind of independently. And so they make her... In the book, you get the sense that she might have been an okay person at one point, but she has truly like lost the plot and become kind of like, I don't know, self-involved or like lost, conniving, what have you. Here, it's a lot more similar to the way that they play Brady. Like, this is a person who could find something out and then use that information to turn things around, right? There's, it's hinted at very briefly in the book where they find out that... his mother was keeping notes about his stuff, like not extensive notes, but she was like, I think my son is up to something and I'm going to, it's like, they find her computer files.
Yeah, they find her Fallout log.
Yes. Right. It's, I was going to say, it's like something from a video game where she's like, I think I can hear the first two code words and they are blah, blah, blah. But what's the third? And it's like, okay, this is our hint for solving the puzzle. And here she is more straightforwardly like, there's something wrong with my son. And that's kind of my fault, but also like he's wrong in a way that is maybe a bit even beyond that. She gets to be a bit more human. Also, I had a bizarre moment here where I had pulled up her page and I was skimming over this bit about her early life. And it says she was in a car accident when she was younger. She was in a head-on collision. It was quite bad. But she came out of it okay. The last sentence on this paragraph is, Lynch spent approximately a year hospitalized and nearly had to have both of her legs amputated. In skimming that, I missed the word nearly.
Yeah.
And I was like,
same experience.
I was like, wait a minute, what? like flashback to me being like, wait a minute, I doubt it. How did that happen? But no, she has both legs.
This is what prepared her for Roadhouse.
Yes.
when she saw what's his name like kick that dude's knee sideways.
Yeah. Went,
that's fine.
Yeah.
I know what that's all about. It means nothing to me.
Uh-huh. But yeah,
I wish they'd let us remake Roadhouse.
A second Roadhouse remake. That's what we need.
We do. We need to. Let me do 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do it. I'll quit everything else I do. Well, I'll probably keep podcasting. I'll quit all other obligations.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll spend 2 years making Roadhouse Remake 2.
Mm-hmm.
I won't put any professional fighters in it. It will be entirely just guys. And probably a couple of pro wrestlers, but not ones that are good.
Mm-hmm.
Because it needs to be in the spirit of the original.
Roadhouses.
That's my promise. That's Roadhouses.
Yep.
The S has got a big dollar sign.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right. Good. Yeah. When's that dang new Predator?
Which dang new Predator? I think they all came out.
Nah, the Badlands? The new old Predator. Yeah, Badlands. When's that coming for home rentals?
Oh, I don't know about that. I know it's been in theaters.
Yeah, it has been. I want to know. Mm-hmm. You can buy it right now at home for like $30 or something, $25. I'm not doing that.
Oh, yeah.
I ain't doing that crap. I'll pay $6 for it. Maybe. Yeah, still only available. Well, is there at least a... Can I buy a physical copy of it at least? Let's look. This is a little preview or a little information for people. I can just buy the dang Blu-ray. Just buy the dang 4K.
What is this a preview of?
This is a preview for people like the kind of thoughts I have.
Oh, okay.
You know, just like what I'm doing in the world, which is like I'm mad about the cost of something. Can I find a physical copy?
Mm-hmm.
Here I go. Okay. Anyway, back to the thing. Yeah. So Kelly Lynch is great. I mean, she's menacing and bad, and as one should. When someone says, hey, maybe you shouldn't be sexually abusing your child, you know, she doubles down.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel bad about it. We think it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
I'm brave mm-hmm. enough to say I think it's bad to do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Turned against the federal government here. Brady likes to make evil jib jabs.
He does make evil jib jabs. People, do you think people know jib jabs?
I don't think they know jib jabs anymore. And I don't think they really even knew what jib jabs were in 2017 when the show was airing, which is why it was so notable to me that Brady makes evil jib jab animations to send to Bill Hodges.
Wait a dang minute. Isn't that the bad word that they use, like the insulting word they use for Holly Gibney? Don't they call her jibber jabber?
Oh, they do. Oh, that's interesting.
Isn't that interesting to think about? Maybe that triggered the jib jab memory for him. If people don't know what a dang jib jab is, you think we're just making a thing up. Which I do know for some of our listeners, we could just be like, well, in 2001, there's a thing called Balubio. And mm-hmm. Balubio was the most popular web, you know, and they'd be like, all right, I guess Balubio is real.
Yeah.
We have a light authority from having been alive.
Yeah. In 2004, we were all talking about the latest web sensation, jib jab.
Are they from 2004?
Yes, because the thing that kicked it off was the election animation.
That's right. I do remember that.
Mm-hmm.
This Land Is Your Land? Was that
yep.
the first one?
Yep.
Before there were epic rap battles of history, before there were the lip sync videos, you know, where people like the bad lip reading videos where people take political actors and other folks and then... Mm-hmm. put in different things. That before any of that, there was jib jab. And jib jab was, as you said, they were for the most part political cartoons, like animations that were kind of, to my memory, I haven't seen a jib jab in a long time, but to my memory, they kind of looked like Terrence and Phillip a little bit, but with photographs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like the head would kind of bob back and forth in mm-hmm. the way that from South Park, Terrence and Phillip would do.
Yeah.
Those raucous Canadians, Terrence mm-hmm. and Phillip.
They've got the similar kind of like ventriloquist dummy mouth thing.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah. And the first one was like a This Land Is Your Land, This Land Is My Land for the 2004 election, which was Kerry Bush. And it was just like the most broad, dumbass political cartoon you could imagine. I remember my history teacher showing it to us like 1,000 times.
Yeah.
And every time, I mean, I had a pretty low opinion of her to begin with, but it lowered my opinion every time. She, you ever told the thing about the feud that my two history teachers got in with one another?
No.
All right. This is good. This is a good one for the thing. So this is perhaps predictable. In my high school, the history teacher you had, you know, there were several of them, but it was really like, what flavor of conservative did you get? There was not like a liberal, you know what I mean?
Yes.
It was right. Like, do you have a libertarian conservative? Do you have like a Bush era Republican? Do you have a Reagan? You know, that was the kind of like, which one did you get? There was no one who was more progressive than that. Mm-hmm. But the libertarian or the pseudo libertarian guy, still conservative Christian guy, whatever, but you know, was willing to during the Bush era in particular, was willing to, you know, speak to the hypocrisy sometimes of the small government Republicans engaging in several world spanning wars, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So at least we had something going. When Dick Cheney shot that guy in the face, you remember that?
Uh-huh.
They made him apologize on TV about it for getting shot in the face. One of the greatest political moments of human history. I mean, just great as in like it damned us to where we are today.
Yep.
Because it, you know, perfectly indexed the kind of like worm culture that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
He put up a sign, like a funny little like forwarded, you know, meme. Jib jab, you're a meme. That was, I'd never like to, I don't want to go hunting with Dick Cheney or something to that effect. Just an ironic sign of Dick Cheney shoots people in the face.
Right.
With a gun and makes them a pot. Right. And so in the world of political forwarding, that ignited apparently in the conservative space and in many spaces for adults who receive political forwards. There was like a Cold War. Or perhaps a hot war, even of responses to these various things.
Mm-hmm.
And so the history teacher that showed us jib jabs constantly put up in her classroom a sign that said, "I'd rather go hunting with Dick Cheney than go for a drive with a Kennedy."
Yep.
Speaking of when the Kennedy drowned that woman, in a drunk driving accident. And that felt like acceleration.
Yeah.
That perhaps was unwarranted.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's in my mind forever. Of like, and again, to speak to the culture we live in today, you know, where everyone's like, everything's all different now. Why is everything bad? That's pretty bad.
Yeah.
That's some bad stuff. And that's like performing in front of 16-year-olds. The like, how cruel can you get? Isn't it fun to be cruel?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my story about it. But she was showing us jib jabs constantly. Brady's making jib jabs, Michael, about murder. He's making murder jib jabs.
He's like, well, look at these people that I killed. I've made them into little jib jab cartoons. And also I've made you into a jib jab cartoon, Bill Hodges.
I'm now flashing back to the fact, I think we talked about jib jabs somewhere on Shelved by Genre when we had the jub jub.
Oh, probably. I bet that came up.
That little demon guy?
Mm-hmm.
He was cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and he also has a bunch of custom like Snapchat filters that he uses to make himself look badass during video calls.
Yep.
Oh boy. Yeah, it's great. I don't know why we started on the jib jab thing.
Because that's kind of in terms of like what Brady does in the show, right? He sends rude emails. I mean, kind of only sends one rude email, right?
Yeah.
He sends repeatedly jib jabs. Like, that's his primary form of communication with Bill Hodges, is sending rude animations he's made. He's like up all night in After Effects, you know, putting this stuff together. He drives the ice cream truck and he goes to work to get tormented by his grind set boss,
mm-hmm.
Roby Frobisher.
Yeah.
And that's kind of it.
Yep.
And then he dresses up like Charles Xavier and tries to bomb an art opening.
Yeah, they can't do a boy band concert. They don't have the budget for that. So they do like an arts gallery thing.
So they like have people reading slam poetry and playing the violin.
That was so funny too. That.
Just, yeah.
First episode has a great mention where Ida, the next door neighbor who wants to jump Bill's bones, is like, oh, you're just going to be over there having another Pepperidge Farm coconut cake, which is a great little thing because the people who made the show clearly read other Stephen King books, because the Pepperidge Farm coconut cake, I don't think I've ever mentioned it on a mainline episode, but it comes up over and over again. Have you noticed it?
Oh.
Oh, like Stephen King characters from like the 90s-ish onwards are constantly buying Pepperidge Farm coconut cakes.
Huh. And like, no, that's never come up for me.
Like, that is a thing. Like, it comes up a lot in like Duma Key. Like, Edgar in that book has eaten lots of Pepperidge Farm cakes. Like, there's also a bit where
I guess I do remember that, because he like goes to the store to buy one specifically at one point.
Mm-hmm. There's also a bit on Bill's desk where you can see there's a big hardcover copy of Four Past Midnight.
I did see that. That's such a specific. I really like that it's not a Dark Tower novel or whatever. It's just Four Past Midnight.
Mm-hmm.
Imagining Bill Hodges reading The Sun Dog.
Right, exactly. He's like, oh, I love the Langoliers.
He does love the Langoliers. Sun Dog's good. I've been thinking about Sun Dog recently. That's a good story.
It is. It's fun.
I don't know how I felt about it then, but now I have fond memories of it.
And so this is like a 10-episode series, or like the 10 episode season. About the first half is a lot of setup and scene setting and whatnot, introducing you to these characters and what they're doing. Episode six is when Holly is introduced, and then the back half of the show from that point onward, again, it's very closely adapted, apart from like the certain changes. And so like the back half of the show becomes this really interesting referendum where the introduction of Holly and Holly's entire deal and who Holly is and what her life has been like, it's another one of those things that's like played against Brady as like she is someone who, similar to Brady, has not had a good life and has been mistreated and has something about her that makes her different, that makes her not relate well to other people. And then what happens to you when you're in that position? Does it produce you as someone who is a mass murderer, or does it produce you as someone who, like Holly, has this insistence on things being right or fair, or like wanting those things to be true, right? Who has been bullied, so she wants to now stand up to bullies and that sort of thing.
And it's made even more complicated too by the additional variable in there is that what happens to someone who is in that position you're talking about when they don't have a safety net?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the other distinguishing thing, right? Like, Holly's family's rich as hell.
Yes.
In the book, like, wealth comes to that family through, like, tech investing or whatever.
Yes.
Like, it's really, really specifically weird. You know, Stephen King loves to go back to the idea, I guess we should talk about it then, but he loves to return to the idea of, like, if only I'd known about Microsoft. Mm-hmm. You know, like, if only I'd known. You know, mm-hmm. like, several different characters do that. Reflect on that or whatever in his books. But here it kind of just seems like everybody's rich. They're just a rich family. Whereas like Brady's family has no money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Except for computers.
I'm looking like through my kind of notes, trying to think like, what is it that we maybe want to talk about?
Well, the thing that's notable here, let me say one thing. The director of a few of these episodes, about a third of them or so, is a guy named Jack Bender. Jack Bender directed about 20-30 episodes of Lost.
I thought that name was familiar.
Directed a bunch of episodes of Under the Dome.
Okay, yep.
And directed a bunch of episodes of The Institute.
Also, Game of Thrones.
He did a Game of Thrones?
Yeah, he did a Game of Thrones. He also did The Sopranos.
Yep.
Huh.
Yeah, real working director. And also the TV movie of The Tempest, if you want to get technical.
Wow.
It's set in Mississippi during the American Civil War, starring Peter Fonda? Have you seen this?
I have not seen this.
We gotta watch. This is a bonus if I've ever seen a bonus.
Wow.
Gideon Prosper, a Southern enslaver, is forced off his plantation by his younger brother Anthony before the American Civil War's outbreak. Surviving in the Mississippi Bayou, Prosper uses magic that he learned from one of the people he enslaved to protect his teenage daughter and to assist the Union.
What?
He's assisting the Union.
Why would he do that?
I don't know. It's not in the summary.
Okay.
Harold Perrineau is in it. He plays Ariel.
Great. Oh, awesome.
If people don't know, he's not Walt, but Walt's dad. What's Walt's dad's name?
I don't know. I don't know.
He's also the cool guy from Romeo and Juliet. Who's that guy?
Mercutio.
He's Mercutio.
Yeah.
Katherine Heigl's in this.
Yeah. Oh, she's
what
Miranda.
The fuck?
This is a TV movie. What did this air on? It was NBC.
No, yeah, we got to watch this.
Yeah.
I'll see if I can find it.
Yeah, this is definitely like an overlap. It is incredible to me that I have not heard about this.
That is surprising to me, yeah, I got to be honest.
It suggests to me that it might be so embarrassing that no one wants to mention it.
I mean, that's cool. That's even better, honestly.
Yeah. And it's like, I've worked on The Tempest. I can't believe that I've worked on The Tempest in Race, so I am so surprised that this did not come up for me.
It looked like it only came out in digital format in Germany.
Okay.
All right, Germany. Come on now. I'll find a copy. I'll figure this out.
Yeah.
Yeah, in terms of like big plotty plot, where is, I guess, the first big move? So, like, you know, Brady's tormenting, you know, Hodges retires. Brady starts tormenting him, saying, "I'm the one who got away." We do get that opening bit. And I forgot to say this in the mainline episode. There's something really, you can feel Stephen King setting up a plot he doesn't go for. Did you feel that at the beginning of the book?
Yes, actually. Yeah, it did feel, I actually had wanted to mention something about that on the episode and I forgot. But what was it wanted to say? Too.
Well, that, so Mr. Mercedes, and the same stuff happens in the in the show here, right? So Brady runs into all these people. He films it.
Yeah.
Which like adds to the, you know, so he's able to like send this horrifying footage to stuff. So there's some good TV adaptational stuff. But we learn after the fact, and I think it's even in the TV show too, that not everyone died. A couple people were, you know, they were run over, so they were paralyzed.
Mm-hmm.
And the book seems to be pretty clearly setting up like an interview later on, or that one of those characters will come back.
Yes.
And they just don't.
Yeah.
And in the TV show, they murder them.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the POV guy from the first chapter is going to appear later in the book, and it just never happens.
Yes. I had that was the exact same thought where I was like, oh, it feels like there was a plot that was going to happen here, and instead it became like the Janie Trelawney and Holly Gibney hour.
Yeah, I think that what happens with the mother probably, mm-hmm. like in a different setup plot, would have been going and interviewing one of the victims rather than interviewing the mother of the woman whose car was stolen, right? Like,
yeah.
That feels like Steve worked himself into a, you know, into this like very weird zone. But they do not make that. There's no ambiguity.
Mm-hmm.
All those people that are POV characters at the beginning, they're all dead. Mm-hmm. So, and so I guess the first big maneuver is like, Bill Hodges is like really losing it to the extent that he's like pointing guns at kids in his yard.
Yeah.
You know? And like we get that, that's I think a lot more in your face clear in the TV show, where it just kind of feels like it's like a guy whose life's kind of going to shit in the book, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he is, I guess, contemplating shooting himself, but other than that.
Yeah, he doesn't pull a gun on a dipshit kid who like falls over in his backyard or however that works out here. It's like a kid, it's like a neighbor kid who's like sneaking out of his own house.
Yeah. They invite him to play hockey. I like that scene.
Yeah, I thought that was really good. The neighborhood kids like playing hockey. Like, this is what I mean. It's like Brendan, not that Stephen King couldn't have written this, but like Brendan Gleeson is good for this type of role of like grumpy old man yelling at the kids playing hockey in the street, and they invite him to play.
They're like, "You want to come play?" He was like, "No." He's like, "I'm an adult man." And then they say, "Well, you can play goalie." And he says, "Why goalie?" And he's like, "Because you're weird. Goalies are weird."
Yes.
And then he's like, "No." You know, he's like insulted and he's mad at them, whatever. He's like, "Get your ball out of my yard," or whatever. And as they're walking away, they go, "We'll let you wear the Jason mask."
Yeah.
That's a cool thing. It's a cool thing to say.
Brady gets a subplot in which he kills a neo-Nazi.
I mean, I get it.
Yeah. Well, it's like we, this is some of what the show is doing to make him seem more sympathetic. In the book, he's constantly dropping the N-word in his inner monologue. Yeah. And here, there's this like conservative Christian guy who comes into work and he gives Lou a bunch of shit. And she complains about it. And this is why she's constantly getting in trouble with the boss, is that there's some sort of implication that this electronics store they're working for is like catering to like conservative clientele somehow.
Yeah.
Or maybe
like only advertise it like white supremacist churches, apparently.
Yeah. And so she is constantly having altercations with the customers where they are like making comments about her looks or like, you know, statements about their assumptions about her lifestyle. And she's not taking it. And so then she's constantly getting in arguments with customers. And then the boss is yelling at her. One of these guys yells at her a whole bunch. And then Brady fixates on him. And it turns out that he is straight up like going to he's like getting divorced. He's going through an epic divorce and he's like living on his own. His life is going to shit. But he's also like a neo-Confederate or something. And Brady uses one of his little magic techno device that allows him to clone doors. He can also change traffic signals with it. And he uses this to get the guy to go drive into an intersection and get run over.
Yep.
Hooray. Yeah.
I mean, you know, you take a win where you can get it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's
the
like...
The Tempest is on YouTube.
Oh, oh boy. Okay.
I'm sending it to you right now.
Thank you. Thank
you
so much.
It's 720p and I think 1080p.
Ooh. But yeah, so yeah, Janie's...
It's wild. I'm sorry.
The thing.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. We're going to talk about another show while we're in the middle of this podcast.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, we are. I'm looking at a plantation owner's being hanged.
Uh-huh. That's what NBC was willing to show you in 1998.
I'm seeing some white people in the woods. I'm seeing Harold Perrineau. He's got long hair. This is wild. This is wild. This is absolutely wild. Oh, my God. Ulysses S. Grant, I think, is here for some reason.
Okay.
There's like some guy who's like gone native. It kind of looks like a white guy who's like in a like a buckskin vest.
Mm-hmm.
Was that in the Tempest?
Not especially, I think.
Okay, all right.
Okay, well, the buckskin vest, I don't know.
All right. Anyway, sorry. Back to the real thing. Yeah, so he does some good stuff, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
Brady. Mm-hmm. But he mostly does bad stuff. That's added. What's new? What's outside the book? Beyond that.
I mean, so I think the biggest, aside from Ida, the neighbor, the thing that I think gets the most extra juice is Brady's work life with Lou, who we've already mentioned, and then his boss, Roby. The grind set boss, who also has his like own plot line that ends with him getting killed to become a fake corpse. Actually, he's a real corpse, but he's passed off as Brady's corpse. That's what I mean to say. And yeah, he's like
kind of root for that guy to get killed by that hammer.
Yeah, you do. He's like, of all the people in the show who are asking to be murdered, he's the one who's asking for it the most.
It's pretty rough to be like, there's a neo-Confederate white supremacist gay basher who exists in the show, and you kind of want to see the grindset guy get it before you that guy. You know? Like, not exclusively. I'm not like, that guy should have lived, and, you know, this guy. Because the moral universe of these kinds of stories is always, you gotta root for somebody, and you gotta hate somebody. That's welcome to genre stories, right? We gotta, and like, who you love and who you hate, that's where the juice is, and like, how will you analyze it? And unfortunately, I have to report that in this story, you hate the grindset guy the most.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who like, looks at marginalized folks and is like, if you just worked a little bit harder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you woke up and you had a little spunk in your step, you'd be living the world.
Yeah, well, he does that thing with Brady where he's like, I'm giving you extra responsibility because I think you're, like, capable of things. And I think you could, like, you know, become something if you applied yourself, which I guess is, like, you know, genuinely true, right? Like, that's, like, that's a nice stance to maybe have toward people, that you want them to succeed and, like, do better. But also, his other way of interacting with Brady is, like, you fucking idiot. You gotta, like, did you shit your pants? You stupid, stupid boy. Like, he like, simultaneously, like, uplifts him and is also, like, constantly insulting him. Mm-hmm. And you know, from a character level, I think it's because, like, we're supposed to understand that, like, this is how this guy works, right? He needs to feel better about himself. And so he enters into this, like, weird deal with Brady. Don't we like, see his, like, shitty apartment later? Doesn't he have, like, a fucking framed anime portrait on the wall?
He does. It's awesome. He has, like, a framed, like, anime... It's like, it's almost like a screenshot.
Yes.
But when you look at it, I'm pretty sure it's hand painted.
Yes.
It's
yes.
Awesome.
It looks
it's,
like
it's perfect. It is such a portrait of a guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's like pre-made all of his food. He's meal prepped his
yes.
whole week.
Yes.
It's great. I love it. Like I don't mean that ironically. I think like it's perfect casting, perfect scene setting, perfect writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so like his whole thing is he has this kind of there's a bit where Brady installs a program on his computer that makes his laptop explode in his face when he's looking at pornography.
That's great.
he singes his eyes or something. But yeah, it culminates in it takes a bit longer than it does in the book, but much as in the book, Brady's mother ends up eating the poisoned hamburger and dying. And then Brady like hangs out with her corpse in the house for a long while. And then he ends up killing his boss and then using his boss's corpse to fake his own death to burn down the house so that in the kind of like last climax, the police force can be like, well, the Mercedes killer is dead because we found a corpse next to his mother's corpse. And that's obviously him. And Bill Hodges and Jerome and Holly can be like, no, he's still out there. There's still something to be done. And then they do it. But that's kind of like, you know, adding a bit more in the way of like stakes to the ending because we have dialed back on doing a terrorist action at a One Direction concert.
That's right. You wonder about there couldn't be anything else, you know, no other event. The maximum event he could find was someone with 80 people at it.
Yeah.
80 donors. I love the speech. I know it's jumping right to the end, but the speech that, cause it's an arts center opening,
mm-hmm.
It's like a gala for the donors.
Yeah.
The mayor's there. And the mayor says, all of the most important people are here. The donors. And it has the feeling of the Lifetime movies and the Hallmark movies we watched. Uh-huh. And it's good. It feels good.
Yes. It felt very much like there was actually some sort of arts event going on in North Carolina and they filmed it.
Yeah.
Like, I think some of these kids, these like teenagers reading slam poetry are actually teenagers reading their slam poetry.
100% is what it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about, I'm just thinking like big moments here, unless you got anything about big plot to say.
Just some additional like information about like what this, because I am interested mm-hmm. in seeing here production timeline. Bill Hodges trilogy books come out 2014, 2015, 2016.
Mm-hmm.
By 2016, they're already talking about this TV series. It doesn't actually happen until 2019. So it's, and by that point, I don't know like what exactly agreement they had, but they did get three seasons and those three seasons adapt ostensibly all three books. But since the series was produced after the books were all out, I am interested in seeing like what they do with things like Ida, because presumably she's a character who will come back and she is like the local mortician. And so there's this interesting thing that happens where she's constantly like, Bill, please date me. Please date me. Like we're in our 60s and single and we live next to each other. Like we get along. We in fact like each other. Let us hang out.
Yeah.
And he's like pushing her away. And then he gets wrapped up with Janie. And he feels bad because she starts, Ida starts realizing something's going on. Then when Janie gets exploded, Ida is the mortician. And so Bill ends up at like the mortuary where the body is as part of like the whole aftermath of that, and has to like see Ida face to face, and Ida being like, yeah, I know you were like sleeping with this woman. I saw her leaving your house.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, like, to say this differently, I don't know if maybe Ida is a character who actually shows up in like book two or three and they've like written her backward, or if there's like something there, right? Yeah. Or yeah. if like they've introduced kind of something new that's always going to be like a little like additional loop or whirl on the story going forward. So there's like some, like I'm interested in kind of some of the setup and like the ways that the divergences here have brought us to that.
Yeah, I have no idea. That's a great question. I didn't look that up either, you know, to kind of figure it out.
Oh, there's a bit where maybe it's Brady in one of his like incel rants or something is talking about horror meisters writing novels. Did you catch that?
I did not.
No, there's someone talks about horror meisters writing novels. One of my notes here is not the regional arts gala and a bunch of exclamation points.
I mean, that's a hard place to be.
Yep. And then instead of using the happy slapper, Holly beats the shit out of him with a fucking dog statue.
Yeah, they do way more in this book. Like way, 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 way more. Like way more. With Bill Hodges has a daughter that he's alienated from.
Yes. Or,
sorry, in the TV show, not the book. And that's it's in the book a little bit, but I wouldn't say it's a big thing in the book. That's like its own subplot here. She's like, don't talk to me. And so like Holly becomes his surrogate daughter, like unambiguously.
Yeah.
Or that's just kind of implied in the book, I would say.
Yeah. And I guess that's something else I'm interested in learning about is like, is the stuff about, because he's not on good terms with his daughter in the book, but it kind of just feels like, the course of things, like he didn't have a good marriage, like whatever. And the show is very specifically say, like showing you, like we get flashbacks to here is an instance in which Bill Hodges was a shitty dad to a complicated young woman. So yeah, we'll see how that plays out, I guess, in future seasons / books. Another thing I was thinking about a lot while watching this was True Detective. Just because I feel like that was, you know, the big kind of detective show, and it never goes fully True Detective, but I think it was the flashbacks where it was like, oh, are they going to try to give us like a secondary plot line? Are we going to try to move or something like that? And then there's a big bit where they do a big montage to a Leonard Cohen song, which felt like a True Detective move to me.
Yeah. I think you need a montage. No. I mean, we get an exercise montage to Here Comes Your Man.
Yeah.
I will say the licensed music for this is like kind of astonishing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they could have spent that on the boy band at the end.
The NSYNC reunion tour.
What do you think about Deborah getting killed?
Fine. Cool. I don't know. It's a lot more horrible here. Because I think in the book, by the time he gets home, she's like already dead, maybe?
No, Michael.
She's like just dying.
She's just dying. And she's like kicking her feet up and down and stuff.
Right.
It's Junji Ito time.
It is.
In the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the TV show's more restrained.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, I think, yeah, she's like her like stomach is distended and huge and she's kicking up and down and like toy soldiering all around. It's pretty rough.
Yeah.
She's in the basement hospital, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty wild.
It was a while ago, so I don't really have strong memory of it. She dies. Right. It's what happens.
She does.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I did just look back at it like 2 hours ago. So, I mean, and there's like all kinds of stuff, I guess, that happens with them in the middle. Like she like is trying to get her job and all that stuff.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah,
that
and it really
guy.
Is just been like the show makes a lot of it does a lot of stuff to be like every time Brady's family is trying to get their shit together, the world's just kicking them in the teeth.
Yeah, no, this is actually
his only thing he can do is turn into Professor X and blow people up.
That is such a sad episode, because what happens is she's like trying to pull herself together. She goes to the hair salon she used to work for because she's clearly thinking of like asking for her old job back. There's a guy who like owns the bar, I think, that's like a few doors down, and he recognizes her because they're people who know each other from way back. And he kind of acts friendly with her and is like, oh, you're out and about, haven't seen you in a while, blah, 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 blah. And he like spends the day with her, like they're like chatting and catching up. And then it all culminates in him just like very grossly sexually propositioning her and mocking her for being an alcoholic and talking about how she would never get her job back because she left on such awful terms with the woman who owns the salon. And he just like just did this whole thing to like rub her face in the mud. And it's so sad.
Yeah, it's not cool. And so then, yeah, you know, like we're just back in the mud again. We're back in the muck.
And it's after that that she goes home and like eats the poisoned hamburger and dies.
What happens?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you eat the poisoned hamburger and die.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's that bulldog statue that Holly at first steals from him. And then he's like, you shouldn't do that. But then she does steal it again and beats the shit out of Brady with it.
How do you think they got there?
Because I don't know.
It's a big statue.
It's such an odd thing.
Because do you think it's like, because there's none of the happy slapper stuff. There's none of Bill Hodges just beating a bunch of black youths in the street. You know, like they're smart enough to not put that in the show. Right. Like anyone other than Steve is like, I don't know about this one.
Right. They don't
the
give.
The optics here are going to be pretty bad.
Jerome does not have his alter ego. They also That's were right, like, yeah, he's not going to be doing that. Not in this.
No, he's just a black kid good at computers. You know what I mean? Like, let's leave it there. So they, I'm trying to like think of what this, it's like the size of like a tall loaf. It's the size of an Xbox 360 is what it is.
Yes.
It's that big.
It's pretty big. Yeah.
It's a big thing. I'm just trying to think, you know, it's the size of like double the size of the Tomier books. So it's pretty big. And I think the way you get there is like, once you've decided that this is the mechanism you're going to use instead of the happy slapper, oh, she'll have a statue. She'll have like an icon of the relationship between her and Bill Hodges. Once you get there, you're like, well, it's got to be kind of big. It can't be little because she's beating a guy in the head with it. So then you got to walk backwards to being like, it's a huge statue she's stolen from his house. To the point where you got to like manufacture a bigger purse for her to put it in.
Yeah.
The purse is so big and the statue so big that it can't, like, it has to fill up the whole thing. There's nothing else in that purse. Like, everything involved with Holly here is kind of weird in that way, where it's like, we've had to work ourselves into a very weird position to make this all happen. The other one is, she has to keep lying to her mother about where she is to go do detective stuff with Bill Hodges. But that means that many scenes have to begin with him saying, where does your mother think you are? And she's like, the movies or baseball game or whatever.
Yeah. Right?
Like a lot of scenes toward the end start beginning with, where does your mother think you are? And she has to verbalize that out loud before like just we just accept cop shit's happening. Right. Like, who cares? It's really funny to me.
Right. And in the book, it's like she just like stops talking to her mom. Like, she's just doing stuff.
Yeah. Send a text message. I also find it, I think I like Holly Gibney as a character, like notionally. I don't know if I like the performance of Holly Gibney here because the way you express, or the way the actress chooses to express like Holly's whole deal is by moving her mouth around a lot.
Yeah.
And it's just like wiggling her. My Very Brave Wife and I began just imitating the mouth wiggle because it's such a, like a actorly thing to do, you know?
Like, I've decided that this is this character's body language.
Yes, and it's not in the body. It's in the mouth specifically. You know, it's kind of like doing an I Dream of Jeannie, you know? Wasn't she wiggling her nose all the time?
Yes, she did. The nose was Samantha from Bewitched.
You got it. I'm
yes,
sorry.
Jeannie from I Dream of Jeannie. From... Yeah, she winked her eyes. She, like, bobbed
she
her head.
She winked her eyes.
Yeah. I watched a lot of those shows and The Monkees.
I watched a lot of those shows, but not The Monkees.
Mm.
I think I found them too silly, those fellas.
I liked the idea of like the monkeys, the band. They're a bunch of guys who live in a weird playhouse together and go on adventures.
Yeah, I think I found it much more enticing than there was like sexy magical ladies in the world.
That's true.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think I was like, okay, all right.
Someday I could find. Oh, sexy,
so you're telling me
lady.
there's like a sexy lady who like has her own like secret pocket dimension she hangs out in. That's cool.
Yeah.
And like a wizard shows up sometimes. They gotta like argue about shit. It's her like terrible cousin or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think I found that like especially I Dream of Jeannie interesting in the same way that I found like the Jetsons or the Flintstones. Where it's like, this is a fucked up little world you live in. That's cool.
Mm-hmm. All these all your appliances are alive and complaining.
Yeah. It's a living.
Mm-hmm.
And like living in your little pocket dimension, you're like, why was Jeannie married to that mortal man? Why'd she do that?
I think they got married later. I think for a while she was just like technically attached to him because he found her bottle or whatever.
Oh, interesting. I kind of always assumed there was some, wait, you're telling me there was some sort of like possession thing going on there?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll be honest. The plot of I, Dream of Jeannie probably didn't stick with me.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, I think the best thing about I Dream of Jeannie is that she's a genie and the male lead is a fucking astronaut.
He is an astronaut.
It's
yeah.
Like, it's such a funny, like,
idea. It's just of the time. You
yes,
know?
Right.
People were astronauts back then. It's kind of like how J. Jonah Jameson's son is an astronaut werewolf.
Uh huh.
You know, just a cool thing to do back then. In case you didn't know this, FYI, people of the world, J. Jonah Jameson, the newspaper man who yells at Peter Parker, his son is both an astronaut and a werewolf. And I think he is a werewolf because he went to the moon, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong about that.
Yeah.
But it's just a fun thing to think about. What do you think about? Okay, there is a thing that maybe the last thing, big thing to talk about is. They do some real police procedural stuff. They determine that he killed Froby.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all that stuff. And I guess the second to last episode is when Brady fakes his death.
Mm-hmm.
But he does it by tricking a SWAT team.
Yeah.
Has there ever been a better, more accurate representation than what happens with the SWAT team? They all show up at his house.
Mm-hmm.
They're all just standing in the street behind a car. Like a whole SWAT team. His house, I guess, has one angle of approach. Perhaps there's a giant brick wall or you know, perhaps hundreds of yards of limestone behind it. There seems to be no one behind the house.
Mm-hmm.
He triggers some sort of jangling sound in his ice cream truck that's parked outside. And they begin to walk toward it, and a cartoon clown's head. No, it's a cartoon smiley face and like a little balloon.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we didn't even talk about this, that he has like a fucking Brady's like calling card is a smiley face, because it doesn't matter. It never matters.
He has an iconic smiley face.
Uh-huh.
It's no mere smiley face. It's like a smirking, evil, trollish smiley.
In the book specifically, it wears sunglasses, but in the TV show, it's just a smiley face.
That's right. Well, it's two things in the TV show. It's the normal smiley face and then like a smirking evil one.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That has like the Joker smile.
Uh-huh.
So, and they're used, you know, flipping back and forth. But this like cartoon little smiley face head pops up and then they just start smoking the shit out of it. They just start shooting the head. And you're like, all right, yep, that's about what I expect from the SWAT team. There's like absolute inability to do anything that's ostensibly part of the job of being in the SWAT team. And then, so they shoot the hell out of this car. And then they go in and do what appears to be the worst breach and clear I've ever seen in human history depicted on a television show. CSI is doing better than this, you know, mm-hmm. in the year 2004. Because a breach and clear for the SWAT team is you dock the door down and everyone just kind of walks around. Just kind of, you know, look around a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then they, of course, trigger the explosion / bomb / firebomb. And that's when Froby's body is used in the place of Brady, and then Brady escapes. And then the last episode's when we find that out. But I think it's a pretty good bait and switch.
Yeah. No. Thought it made sense. As I said, it like sort of raises the stakes because it puts the book is much more like Bill Hodges carries on a criminal investigation while hoping the police don't find out. And the police basically don't care because they've got their own thing going on. And the show makes more of a point. We have his old partner who multiple times is calling him in and being like, Bill, seems like you're doing investigation on your own. I don't think you should be doing that. I think you're an old man who's retired. You're going to cause problems.
Pete.
Yep.
Pete.
And so.
From Time Cop.
Yep. He's Darth Vader now.
Damn, he's Darth Vader now?
Yeah, he does. He's like a voice double for James Earl Jones, and he does the Darth Vader voice in, I think, the video games.
Oh.
Yeah. Can't remember the actor's name, though.
He apparently was on the George Lucas talk show.
Well, okay.
That's fun.
Yeah. But yeah, so that's like another slight difference actually in the show, right? Is that the police presence is more there and it has more of an effect on things. For some reason, the last note that I wrote on episode 10 is radio tuning. What do I mean by that?
I can tell you that. So, okay. What happens in the finale, right? So you go, Brady dresses up like Charles Xavier. And he goes into the art opening. He gets his bomb out, preps all that, stabs his friend. Bill Hodges distracts him by, he's going to shoot him, but Bill Hodges is having a heart attack. He's going to shoot Brady. And then Holly Gibney comes out of nowhere and clubs him over the head. You know, that's all the stuff we've talked about. Then what happens is we wake up in the hospital. And Bill Hodges is there. And Bill Hodges has apparently been getting up out of his bed every day and just going and looking at Brady, who is in a coma currently. And like the doctor's like, you know, there's actually a pretty good line. I like this a lot. She says, you know, you don't have to keep coming in here. He's never going to wake up. He has, you know, the same electrical activity as 5-year-old batteries in your remote. And Brendan Gleeson, this is a line that could easily not work. You know, if you told me this wouldn't work, I would believe you. But he says, well, you know what? You give me a few minutes of tapping on that remote and smacking it, I'll get it to turn the TV on. You know, and that's good. Like he's so serious about that.
Yeah.
Pretty good. And then he goes in and he's like, I know you're in there. Blah, blah, blah. You know, he starts talking mad shit. And I love that, like, no one will let him be in the room alone with Brady because they know he'll kill him.
Yeah.
So, like, the cop comes in the room with him and stands there and watches him. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Just excellent. And anyway, he leaves. And after he leaves, he, like, you know, gets wheeled out in a wheelchair, all that kind of stuff, you know, because he's leaving the hospital. We cut back to Brady and we slow push in on Brady's head in a radio tuning noise comes in. It starts going through the channels and it lands on a very staticky version of Here Comes Your Man.
Oh, that's right.
And there you go. That's the last shot of the thing. Now you know.
Okay. Well, yeah, and that's Mr. Mercedes, the TV show.
But notably, as you not the very end of the book, which like unambiguously has him coming back, you know?
Yeah, and he's asking for his mother.
He's instead not doing that. He's in a coma still. But yeah, that's the deal. That's Mr. Mercedes. I think it's a great TV show. It's a great adaptation. I mean, you know, it's... We didn't say this is a mailing episode. Say it here. I think it's probably just like a thing that you could intuit from literally everything in the earth. But it's just, you know, good old fashioned cops doing cop shit. And if you have no tolerance for that, which I guess I understand, then like this is not a thing you would enjoy whatsoever. But if you have tolerance for that, you understand, you know, or you have an enjoyment of that genre of like cops doing real like, kind of boring but effective cop stuff. This is just that thing.
Yep.
you got all the hits. You got a horny neighbor. You got a kid with a broken arm. You got an evil, villain.
Mm-hmm. You got a cool lesbian.
You got a cool lesbian talking wild shit every time she's on screen.
Mm-hmm.
Giving people spray paint. Being concerned. Getting stabbed. It's all the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good show. I enjoyed it. I don't know how much I'm going to love. I hope that the budget increases and or the stakes get higher.
Yeah.
Because the stakes of Mr. Mercedes is across the board, both the book and TV show, there's not the biggest stakes on the earth. Like, mm-hmm. do you catch a guy who already got away with it or not?
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of the people in the book, Brady kills one more person. And it's really just because Bill Hodges made him do it. He bullied him into killing another guy.
Yeah.
Or killing that lady, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, he...
That's it, right? Doesn't he just blow her up? Is there anyone else?
Oh, yeah, I guess. I mean,
in the book,
he kills his mother, but yeah,
he kills his mother, but that's kind of like a weird accident.
That's an accident. Yeah, he gets like one more to his body count.
Yeah.
Huh.
And one gets a sense of like Bill Hodges just like ignored that email. He might not have ever killed anybody again.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, real Batman Joker scenario.
Brady's...
Maybe if he hadn't put on the cowl, there never would have been a Joker.
That's right.
Who could have known? All right. Well, that's great. Next bonus episode, next month, we're going to be doing The Long Walk, the only adaptation of The Long Walk that has happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very famously, I said like years ago now, probably, is that Mick Garris said, you know, everyone for years has always had a Long Walk script and no one could ever figure out how to do it. You know, how to like make it actually a compelling movie, and no one probably will, is what he said. And then it happened after we said that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious about, does it happen?
Yeah.
I've tried to the best of my ability to not learn anything about it. So I'm going in as fresh as I can. And I'm eager to watch it.
Same. I've heard good things about it. I think I talked about it with Allison, and I think Allison had a good time with it. And so we talked about that. Looking forward to seeing how Mark Hamill does.
Oh yeah, he's the general, right?
Yeah, the major.
Interesting. Speaking of the Joker.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now Skeletor or whatever, is that right?
I don't know.
I think they have him in the He-Man movie.
I won't be looking at that.
Who cares, yeah.
I mean, it's not who cares. I just like, that's nostalgia bait for someone who's not me.
I was gonna say, nostalgia bait for someone who has nostalgia for a thing that I never experienced.
Yeah. I can never judge someone for having nostalgia for a toy. But at least the nostalgia I have for toys, my toys are unambiguously cooler than those toys. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Take any Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. We know that they are cooler than a He-Man action figure, right?
I think
don't
that's
we agree?
True. I think that's true, honestly.
Can anyone, you know, confidently tell me that's not the case? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen those bootleg TMNT toys?
No, maybe not.
Are you a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle guy? You are,
not especially. No, not really.
No,
but
you are. Come on.
What?
You know.
I'm not like tracking the toys. I'm not that level.
Well, so there's a new short from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, what do you call it? Like the Mutant Mayhem style?
Uh-huh.
That is in front of some other animated film that I don't care about.
Okay.
And in that, it's about like AI-generated toys of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Uh-huh.
I think. And so they've released them. Like, they've released the toys from the short.
Can I?
And so they're like, the dimensions are like stretched too weird and stuff. They're very cool looking.
Can I look these up?
I'm trying to find the thing for them, and I'm having a hard time. I saw them on social media.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, unfortunately, typing in bootleg TMNT gives me so many things that are not maybe the thing you're talking about.
TMNT. Let me see if I can do it. I'll try one time live on air. TMNT toys. Let's see here. New short, AI generated. Yeah. Here we go. I found it. Apparently Donatello is using ChatGPT in the thing.
Oh no. Donatello, no.
Donatello, no. So it's apparently the shortest Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Chrome Alone 2, Lost in New Jersey.
Okay.
The name of it, I think. Yeah. So it's from this last year. Toys. So let me find it here. Yeah, here we go. Yeah, they are called Tubular Tortoise Karate.
Hold.
All right, this is good stuff for them than Just King things.
Uh-huh. Leo and Nardo. This is funny. Yeah. This is good.
They're cool. This was worth the juice, right? This is worth, like, see, Danny. And so, like, they're the TMNT things, but, like, the dimensions are just kind of all messed up. And, like, their weapons aren't correct.
Uh-huh.
And they're goofy looking.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Donnie and Danny, Mikey and Mark. Mark is the Mikey one. They're good. He-Man would never.
Good.
They would never do this. But yeah, so yeah, they're called the Tubular Tortoise Karate Warriors. If you want to look them up.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, are you seeing the
Yes, no, Michael this is Angela funny. One? This is funny. Yeah. They're good.
This was worth all the juice here. I'm just putting mm-hmm. the chat so I can look at it again later. Leo and Nardo. What's the Raph one? I don't see Raphael. Oh yeah, maybe
Nardo, Ralph, Danny, and Mark.
That's what Raph and Ralph. They're good. That's a good toy. I told my friend who has children who are he's a TMNT fan and also has children who are of the appropriate age to do it, and he I think went and bought all of them immediately.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Good stuff.
All right, well, I'll talk to you.
You've all learned something today.
You have. Thank you so much for supporting us on Patreon. Just King things. Woo.
Yeah, we'll be back with The Long Walk. I'm really excited about that, really curious about it. Going to be really one of those great experiences where it's been so long since we read the book. I'll be like, is that in the book? And you'll have to be like, I don't know. And we'll like be like, oh, maybe.
I pull open the book and it's like, the major, who was Mark Hamill? And like, yeah, that was in the book. Oh, okay.
It was in the book. Yeah. Huh. Known for his famous voice acting and for his role as Luke Skywalker. Okay, cool. All right. That's it.
Yeah.
Michael, who do we do it for?
We do it for Steve.